Section 6 of Orlando by Virginia Woolf. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose as long as Legamus is credited. Chapter 2, Part 3. And here we may profit by a pause in his soliloquy to reflect how odd it was to see Orlando stretched there on his elbow on a June day, and to reflect that this fine fellow, with all his faculties about him, and a healthy body, witness cheeks and limbs, a man who never thought twice about heading a charge or fighting a duel, should be so subject to the lethargy of thought, and rendered so susceptible by it, that when it came to a question of poetry, or his own competence in it, he was as shy as a little girl behind her mother's cottage door. In our belief, Green's ridicule of his tragedy hurt him as much as the princess's ridicule of his love. But to return. Orlando went on thinking. He kept looking at the grass and at the sky, and trying to bethink him what a true poet, who has his verses published in London, would say about them. Memory, meanwhile, whose habits have already been described, kept steady before his eyes the face of Nicholas Green, as if that sardonic, loose-lipped man, treacherous as he had proved himself, were the muse in person, and it was to him that Orlando must do homage. So Orlando, that summer morning, offered him a variety of phrases, some plain, others figured, and Nick Green kept shaking his head and sneering, and muttering something about Glore and Cicero, and the death of poetry in our time. At length, starting to his feet, it was now winter and very cold, Orlando swore one of the most remarkable oaths of his lifetime, for it bound him to a servitude than which none is stricter. "I'll be blasted," he said, "if I ever write another word, or try to write another word, to please Nick Green or the Muse. Bad, good, or indifferent, I'll write, from this day forward, to please myself." And here he made as if he were tearing a whole budget of papers across, and tossing them in the face of that sneering, loose-lipped man. Upon which, as a cur ducks if you stoop to shy a stone at him, Memory ducked her effigy of Nick Green out of sight, and substituted for it nothing whatever. But Orlando, all the same, went on thinking. He had indeed much to think of. For when he tore the parchment across, he tore, in one rending, the scrolloping, emblazoned scroll which he had made out in his own favour in the solitude of his room, appointing himself, as the king appoints ambassadors, the first poet of his race, the first writer of his age, conferring eternal immortality upon his soul, and granting his body a grave among laurels, and the intangible banners of a people's reverence perpetually. Eloquent as this all was, he now tore it up and threw it in the dustbin. "Fame," he said, "is like—" And since there was no Nick Green to stop him, he went on to revel in images of which we will choose only one or two of the quietest. "A braided coat which hampers the limbs, a jacket of silver which curbs the heart, a painted shield which covers a scarecrow, etc., etc." The pith of his phrases was that, while fame impedes and constricts, obscurity wraps about a man like a mist. Obscurity is dark, ample, and free. Obscurity lets the mind take its way unimpeded. Over the obscure man is poured the merciful suffusion of darkness. None knows where he goes or comes. He may seek the truth and speak it. He alone is free. He alone is truthful. He alone is at peace. And so he sank into a quiet mood under the oak tree, the hardness of whose roots, exposed above the ground, seemed to him rather comfortable than otherwise. Sunk for a long time in profound thoughts as to the value of obscurity, and the delight of having no name, but being like a wave which returns to the deep body of the sea, thinking how obscurity rids the mind of the irk of envy and spite, how it sets running in the veins the free waters of generosity and magnanimity, and allows giving and taking without thanks offered or praise given, which must have been the way of all great poets, he supposed, though his knowledge of Greek was not enough to bear him out. For, he thought, Shakespeare must have written like that, and the church builders built like that, anonymously, needing no thanking or naming, but only their work in the daytime, and a little ale, perhaps, at night. "What an admirable life this is," he thought, stretching his limbs out under the oak tree. "And why not enjoy it this very moment?" The thought struck him like a bullet. Ambition dropped like a plummet. Rid of the heartburn of rejected love, and of vanity rebuked, and all the other stings and pricks which the nettle-bed of life had burnt upon him when ambitious of fame, but could no longer inflict upon one careless of glory. He opened his eyes, which had been wide open all the time, but had seen only thoughts, and saw, lying in the hollow beneath him, his house. There it lay, in the early sunshine of spring. It looked a town rather than a house, but a town built not hither and thither, as this man wished or that, but circumspectly, by a single architect with one idea in his head. Courts and buildings, grey, red, plum colour, lay orderly and symmetrical. The courts were some of them oblong and some square. In this was a fountain, in that a statue. The buildings were some of them low, some pointed. Here was a chapel, there a belfry. Spaces of the greenest grass lay in between, and clumps of cedar trees and beds of bright flowers. All were clasped, yet so well set out was it, that it seemed that every part had room to spread itself fittingly, by the roll of a massive wall, while smoke from innumerable chimneys curled perpetually into the air. This vast, yet ordered building, which could house 1,000 men, and perhaps 2,000 horses, was built, Orlando thought, by workmen whose names are unknown. Here have lived, for more centuries than I can count, the obscure generations of my own obscure family. Not one of these Richards, Johns, Annes, Elizabeths, has left a token of himself behind him, yet all, working together with their spades and their needles, their love-making and their child-bearing, have left this. Never had the house looked more noble and humane. Why, then, had he wished to raise himself above them? For it seemed vain and arrogant in the extreme to try to better that anonymous work of creation, the labours of those vanished hands. Better was it to go unknown and leave behind you an arch, a potting-shed, a wall where peaches ripen, than to burn like a meteor and leave no dust. For after all, he said, kindling as he looked at the great house on the greensward below, the unknown lords and ladies who lived there never forgot to set aside something for those who will come after, for the roof that will leak, for the tree that will fall. There was always a warm corner for the old shepherd in the kitchen, always food for the hungry, always their goblets were polished, though they lay sick, and their windows were lit, though they lay dying. Lords though they were content to go down into obscurity with the mole-catcher and the stonemason. Obscure noblemen, forgotten builders. Thus he apostrophised them with a warmth that entirely gainsaid such critics as called him cold, indifferent, slothful, the truth being that equality often lies just on the other side of the wall from where we seek it. Thus he apostrophised his house and race in terms of the most moving eloquence. But when it came to the peroration, and what is eloquence that lacks peroration, he fumbled. He would have liked to have ended with a flourish, to the effect that he would follow in their footsteps and add another stone to their building. Since, however, the building already covered 9 acres, to add even a single stone seemed superfluous. Could one mention furniture in a peroration? Could one speak of chairs and tables and mats to lie beside people's beds? For whatever the peroration wanted, that was what the house stood in need of. Leaving his speech unfinished for the moment, he strode downhill again, resolved henceforward to devote himself to the furnishing of the mansion. The news, that she was to attend him instantly, brought tears to the eyes of good old Mrs. Grimsditch, now grown somewhat old. Together they perambulated the house. The towel-horse in the king's bedroom. "And that was King Jamie, my lord," she said. hinting that it was many a day since a king had slept under their roof, but the odious Parliament days were over, and there was now a crown in England again. Lacked a leg. There were no stands to the ewers in the little closet leading into the waiting-room of the Duchess's page. Mr. Green had made a stain on the carpet with his nasty pipe-smoking, which she and Judy, for all their scrubbing, had never been able to wash out. Indeed, when Orlando came to reckon up the matter of furnishing with rosewood chairs and cedarwood cabinets, with silver basins, china bowls, and Persian carpets, every one of the 365 bedrooms which the house contained, he saw that it would be no light one, and if some thousands of pounds of his estate remained over, these would do little more than hang a few galleries with tapestry, set the dining-hall with fine carved chairs, and provide mirrors of solid silver and chairs of the same material, for which he had an inordinate passion, for the furnishing of the royal bedchambers. He now set to work in earnest, as we can prove beyond a doubt if we look at his ledgers. Let us glance at an inventory of what he bought at this time, with the expenses totted up in the margin, but these we omit. To 50 pairs of Spanish blankets, ditto curtains of crimson and white taffeta, the valance to them of white satin, embroidered with crimson and white silk. To 70 yellow satin chairs and 60 stools, suitable with their buckram covers to them all. To 67 walnut tree tables. To 17 dozen boxes, containing each dozen 5 dozen of Venice glasses. To 102 mats, each 30 yards long. To 97 cushions of crimson damask, laid with silver parchment lace and footstools of cloth of tissue and chairs suitable. To 50 branches for a dozen lights apiece. Already, it is an effect lists have upon us, we are beginning to yawn. But if we stop, it is only that the catalogue is tedious, not that it is finished. There are 99 pages more of it, and the total sum dispersed ran into many thousands, that is to say millions of our money. And if his day was spent like this, at night again, Lord Orlando might be found reckoning out what it would cost to level a million molehills if the men were paid 10 pence an hour, and again, how many hundredweight of nails at 5 pence halfpenny a gill were needed to repair the fence round the park, which was 15 miles in circumference, and so on and so on. The tale, we say, is tedious, for one cupboard is much like another, and one molehill not much different from a million. Some pleasant journeys it cost him, and some fine adventures. As, for instance, when he set a whole city of blind women near Bruges to stitch hangings for a silver-canopied bed, and the story of his adventure with a Moor in Venice, of whom he bought, but only at the sword's point, his lacquered cabinet, might, in other hands, prove worth the telling. Nor did the work lack variety, for here would come, drawn by teams from Sussex, great trees to be sawn across and laid along the gallery for flooring, and then a chest from Persia, stuffed with wool and sawdust, from which, at last, he would take a single plate, or one topaz ring. At length, however, there was no room in the galleries for another table, no room on the tables for another cabinet, no room in the cabinet for another rose bowl, no room in the bowl for another handful of potpourri. There was no room for anything anywhere. In short, the house was furnished. In the garden, snowdrops, crocuses, hyacinths, magnolias, roses, lilies, asters, the dahlia in all its varieties, pear trees and apple trees and cherry trees and mulberry trees, with an enormous quantity of rare and flowering shrubs, of trees evergreen and perennial, grew so thick on each other's roots that there was no plot of earth without its bloom, and no stretch of sward without its shade. In addition, he had imported wild fowl with gay plumage, and 2 Malay bears, the surliness of whose manners concealed, he was certain, trusty hearts. All was now ready, and when it was evening, and the innumerable silver sconces were lit, and the light airs which forever moved about the galleries stirred the blue and green arras, so that it looked as if the huntsman were riding and Daphne flying, when the silver shone, and lacquer glowed, and wood kindled, when the carved chairs held their arms out, and dolphins swam upon the walls with mermaids on their backs, when all this and much more than all this was complete and to his liking, Orlando walked through the house with his elk-hounds following, and felt content. He had matter now, he thought, to fill out his peroration. Perhaps it would be well to begin the speech all over again. Yet, as he paraded the galleries, he felt that still something was lacking. Chairs and tables, however richly gilt and carved, sofas, resting on lions' paws with swans' necks curving under them, beds of even the softest swan's down, are not, by themselves, enough. People sitting in them, people lying in them, improve them amazingly. Accordingly, Orlando now began a series of very splendid entertainments to the nobility and gentry of the neighbourhood. The 365 bedrooms were full for a month at a time. Guests jostled each other on the 52 staircases. 300 servants bustled about the pantries. Banquets took place almost nightly. Thus, in a very few years, Orlando had worn the nap off his velvet and spent the half of his fortune, but he had earned the good opinion of his neighbours, held a score of offices in the county, and was annually presented with perhaps a dozen volumes dedicated to his lordship in rather fulsome terms by grateful poets. For, though he was careful not to consort with writers at that time, and kept himself always aloof from ladies of foreign blood, still he was excessively generous both to women and to poets, and both adored him. But when the feasting was at its height, and his guests were at their revels, he was apt to take himself off to his private room alone. There, when the door was shut, and he was certain of privacy, he would have out an old writing-book, stitched together with silk stolen from his mother's work-box, and labelled in a round schoolboy hand, The Oak Tree, a Poem. In this he would write till midnight chimed, and long after. But, as he scratched out as many lines as he wrote in, the sum of them was often, at the end of the year, rather less than at the beginning, and it looked as if, in the process of writing, the poem would be completely unwritten. For it is for the historian of letters to remark that he had changed his style amazingly. His floridity was chastened, his abundance curbed, the age of prose was congealing those warm fountains. The very landscape outside was less stuck about with garlands, and the briars themselves were less thorned and intricate. Perhaps the senses were a little duller, and honey and cream less seductive to the palate. Also that the streets were better drained, and the houses better lit, had its effect upon the style, it cannot be doubted. One day he was adding a line or two, with enormous labour, to The Oak Tree, a Poem, when a shadow crossed the tail of his eye. It was no shadow, he soon saw, but the figure of a very tall lady in riding-hood and mantle, crossing the quadrangle on which his room looked out. As this was the most private of the courts, and the lady was a stranger to him, Orlando marvelled how she had got there. 3 days later the same apparition appeared again, and on Wednesday noon appeared once more. This time Orlando was determined to follow her, nor apparently was she afraid to be found, for she slackened her steps as he came up and looked him full in the face. Any other woman thus caught in a lord's private grounds would have been afraid. Any other woman with that face, headdress, and aspect would have thrown her mantilla across her shoulders to hide it. For this lady resembled nothing so much as a hare startled but obdurate, a hare whose timidity is overcome by an immense and foolish audacity, a hare that sits upright and glowers at its pursuer with great bulging eyes, with ears erect but quivering, with nose pointed but twitching. This hare, moreover, was 6 feet high, and wore a headdress into the bargain, of some antiquated kind which made her look still taller. Thus confronted, she stared at Orlando, with a stare in which timidity and audacity were most strangely combined. First she asked him, with a proper but somewhat clumsy curtsey, to forgive her her intrusion. Then, rising to her full height again, which must have been something over 6'2", she went on to say, but with such a cackle of nervous laughter, so much tee-heeing and haw-hawing, that Orlando thought she must have escaped from a lunatic asylum, that she was the Archduchess Harriet Griselda of Finster Ahorn and Skandop Boom in the Romanian territory. She desired above all things to make his acquaintance, she said. She had taken lodging over a baker's shop at the park gates. She had seen his picture, and it was the image of a sister of hers who was, here she guffawed, long since dead. She was visiting the English court. The Queen was her cousin. The King was a very good fellow, but seldom went to bed sober. Here she tee-heed and haw-hawed again. In short, there was nothing for it but to ask her in and give her a glass of wine. Indoors, her manners regained the hauteur natural to a Romanian archduchess, and had she not shown a knowledge of wines rare in a lady, and made some observations upon firearms and the customs of sportsmen in her country, which were sensible enough, the talk would have lacked spontaneity. Jumping to her feet at last, she announced that she would call the following day, swept another prodigious curtsey, and departed. The following day Orlando rode out. The next he turned his back, on the third he drew his curtain. On the fourth it rained, and as he could not keep a lady in the wet, nor was altogether averse to company, he invited her in, and asked her opinion, whether a suit of armour, which belonged to an ancestor of his, was the work of Jacobi or of Top. He inclined to Top. She held another opinion, it matters very little which. But it is of some importance to the course of our story, that in illustrating her argument, which had to do with the working of the tie-pieces, the Archduchess Harriet took the golden shin-case and fitted it to Orlando's leg. That he had a pair of the shapeliest legs that any nobleman has ever stood upright upon has already been said. Perhaps something in the way she fastened the ankle-buckle, or her stooping posture, or Orlando's long seclusion, or the natural sympathy which is between the sexes, or the burgundy, or the fire, any of these causes may have been to blame, for certainly blame there is on one side or another, when a nobleman of Orlando's breeding, entertaining a lady in his house, and she his elder by many years, with a face a yard long and staring eyes, dressed somewhat ridiculously too, in a mantle and riding-cloak, though the season was warm. Blame there is when such a nobleman is so suddenly and violently overcome by passion of some sort that he has to leave the room. But what sort of passion, it may well be asked, could this be? And the answer is as double-faced as love herself. For love, but leaving love out of the argument for a moment, the actual event was this. When the Archduchess Harriet Griselda stooped to fasten the buckle, Orlando heard, suddenly and unaccountably, far off, the beating of love's wings. The distant stir of that soft plumage roused in him a thousand memories of rushing waters, of loveliness in the snow and faithlessness in the flood, and the sound came nearer, and he blushed and trembled, and he was moved as he had never thought to be moved again, and he was ready to raise his hands and let the bird of beauty alight on his shoulders when, horror, a creaking sound like that the crows make tumbling over the trees began to reverberate. The air seemed dark with coarse black wings, voices croaked, bits of straw, twigs and feathers dropped, and there pitched down upon his shoulders the heaviest and foulest of the birds, which is the vulture. Thus he rushed from the room, and sent the footman to see the Archduchess Harriet to her carriage. For love, to which we may now return, has two faces, one white, the other black, two bodies, one smooth, the other hairy. It has two hands, two feet, two nails, two indeed of every member, and each one is the exact opposite of the other. Yet so strictly are they joined together, that you cannot separate them. In this case, Orlando's love began her flight towards him, with her white face turned, and her smooth and lovely body outwards. Nearer and nearer she came, wafting before her airs of pure delight. All of a sudden, at the sight of the Archduchess, presumably, she wheeled about, turned the other way round, showed herself black, hairy, brutish, and it was lust the vulture, not love the bird of paradise, that flopped foully and disgustingly upon his shoulders. Hence he ran, hence he fetched the footman. But the harpy is not so easily banished as all that. Not only did the Archduchess continue to lodge at the baker's, but Orlando was haunted every day and night by phantoms of the foulest kind. Vainly, it seemed, had he furnished his house with silver and hung the walls with arras, when at any moment a dung-bedraggled fowl could settle upon his writing-table. There she was, flopping about among the chairs. He saw her waddling ungracefully across the galleries. Now she perched, top-heavy, upon a fire-screen. When he chased her out, back she came and pecked at the glass till she broke it. Thus realizing that his home was uninhabitable, and that steps must be taken to end the matter instantly, he did what any other young man would have done in his place, and asked King Charles to send him as ambassador extraordinary to Constantinople. The king was walking in Whitehall. Nell Gwynne was on his arm. She was pelting him with hazelnuts. 'Twas a thousand pities, that amorous lady sighed, that such a pair of legs should leave the country. Howbeit, the fates were hard. She could do no more than toss one kiss over her shoulder before Orlando sailed. End of section 6.